Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. When Ducks Unlimited Canada looked at why so many waterfowl species are losing ground, they realized farming practices have a huge impact on duck populations. One of those is spring seeding, because ducks like to lay their eggs in farmers' fields. So DU has launched a big program to promote winter wheat. And the Sustainable Forest Management Network has released some new research that indicates gender and economics play important roles in whether countries pursue forest certification. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. Now that fall is here, prairie farmers are busy harvesting their spring crop. But there's another group of farmers who are already seeding next year's crop. There's a new emphasis on planting winter wheat, and the big push behind this is Ducks Unlimited Canada. Ducks actually lay their eggs in nests that are quite a distance from water, and they especially love farmers' fields. But nests don't last very long once the cultivators start turning up the soil in the spring. Dale Soutart is a winter cereals agronomist with Ducks Unlimited Canada.
Ducks Unlimited is interested in winter wheat for the nesting cover aspect of it. It's a cereal crop, not unlike spring wheat, but it's seeded in the fall. It grows to about the 3-4 leaf stage in the fall and overwinters as such. And in the springtime, all we require on it then is a herbicide application or perhaps a fertilizer application. The big thing is no disturbance from a tillage implement, so no seeding, no cultivation, no types of that equipment. So any nests that are initiated on those fields are relatively undisturbed.
What's the difference between spring wheat and winter wheat?
It matures earlier. It perhaps requires a little bit higher nutrient level due to the fact that it's got a higher yield potential. So the potential for yields are higher. Typically the price as compared to hard red spring wheat is not quite as good, but very comparable to CPS wheats. You know, it really changes the workload on Alberta farms to spread out workload, get harvest done earlier, and escape some disease or insect infestations and those types of things.
When you look at the differences between the spring and the winter wheat, from the farmer's perspective, do they go into the same markets? Are they used for the same types of flowers?
They can be. Millers are, I think, just starting to discover the benefits of winter wheat and the qualities that can be attractive to them. They are somewhat different. Hard red springs are typically used for white breads and the loaves we typically buy in the supermarket. But the Asian noodle market, Oriental flatbreads for export, tends to be a good fit for winter wheat. Pizza crusts and doughs and are also good fits. But like I say, quantities are still relatively small coming out of Canada, and I think the millers have yet to discover the real potential of winter wheat.
How large is this program? How many acres do you have right now under winter wheat production?
There's approximately 160,000 acres of winter wheat in that's being harvested this fall. That's up from about 100,000 acres last year in Alberta. Across Canada, we're seeing the acres approaching about 700,000. Manitoba is a big increased user of winter wheat due to the escape mechanism that winter wheat provides over fusarium. Fusarium is a real problem in Manitoba, and they're finding that winter wheat, with its earlier maturity and quicker harvest, can escape fusarium infection, and it's providing a really good feed source for the hogs and other livestock in Manitoba.
Is that a mold?
It's a type of fungal infection that affects the seed, and it's transmitted very easily from year to year and from cereal to cereal. So it's becoming a real problem in south Manitoba and southeast Saskatchewan. There's some fungicides that can attack it and help prevent the disease and some seed treatments, but they've proven to be, less than 100% reliable. So if we can avoid the infection times by planting an earlier maturing wheat like winter wheat, where it's flowering about 3 weeks earlier, avoiding the typical infection times of fusarium, we're finding a good way to escape it in that way.
Is there any danger of the wheat sprouting too early?
because, you know, you think, well, the snow's coming, it's going to freeze.
Yeah, that winter wheat does sprout very early. It's one of the benefits of winter wheat that when we seed, typically fall tends to be a little bit drier time. You're just coming off of a crop production year, and conditions can be dry at times, and producers get wary that the soil is too dry. Winter wheat takes very little water to germinate and get going in the fall time, so it is one of the benefits. But at this time of year, when we're seeing winter wheat being harvested, it can be a problem if winter wheat sits down in the swath and gets some moisture on it, that it can sprout easily. So we are seeing most of it straight cut, which is which is a good idea and avoids most of the sprouting issues, but more of a benefit than a downfall, I would say.
Well, does this mean then that you can use your field all year round, as opposed to just the few months through the summer?
That's certainly one of the scenarios. In southern Alberta, where erosion tends to be a bit of a problem, we're seeing winter wheat growing for that purpose after potatoes or dry beans, for example. We're seeing winter wheat go in. Not only does winter wheat use early spring moisture, which in southern Alberta and dry land, that's sometimes all they get down there. We are seeing it do very well under those conditions. And it also requires higher heat units, which is available by growing in the fall sometime, early, and then carrying on into summertime. It does very well to utilize that. But it does give us more options to keep crop in the field and change workload around. So instead of harvesting in a month or a month and a half time, we're spreading that out, and we're using our seeding equipment over longer periods of time. And real benefit to producers, spreading the workload and keeping crop on the land longer.
Do you see this as being something that we might move more towards as we deal with climate change issues?
Certainly it can be a factor. We're seeing a lot of interest from the greenhouse gas program that is out right now. With winter wheat's ability to use higher levels of fertility and also more efficiently use fertility and moisture, we're seeing a big push from the greenhouse gas side to use a crop like winter wheat. It's very effective in nutrient management and moisture utilization. But certainly with the trend that we seem to be having with less moisture, with less rainfall, we need to take advantage of every stitch of it. And when we get snow melt and those types of things, the early spring moisture that for a spring crop we typically wait to subside to seed into, winter wheat, we're able to take advantage of most of that moisture and makes it very effective and a good crop, and that's where the increased yield potential comes from.
What sort of incentive do you offer farmers?
We don't. We used to offer per acre payments to producers and found that for the long term they were unreliable. Producers felt that the crop needed to be subsidized, and certainly not the case. If you look at the numbers of successful producers, they are making as much, if not more, money net per acre from winter wheat production. The long-term goal of Ducks Unlimited is to have winter wheat as a dominant crop in Western Canada, and per acre payments or those types of subsidies don't give the producer the idea that it can stand alone on its own. And when the per acre payments typically stopped, the production would stop. So what we're trying to do is work with 30 or 40 producers across central Alberta. We've got a few more in northern Alberta and probably 30 in southern Alberta that can act as extension agents for us, central locations to spread their success stories around their individual area. It gives us a place to tour fields and give new producers or interested producers a place to come out near their area to see winter wheat production being successful right close to them.
Well, let's look at this from the Ducks' perspective, because you mentioned that one of the real benefits is not disturbing the nests that might be in the field. What's the problem there?
The problem with traditional agriculture is with over 20 million acres conventionally spring seeded in Alberta, any seeding implement that tends to come through the field, if there is a nest there, it gets destroyed. And by seeding winter wheat, not only is it benefiting Alberta producers by increasing their net returns and spreading their workload, but it's also providing increased habitat for waterfowl. Nests that are present in those areas typically don't get destroyed. Predators, it provides good cover over predators, and they are quite They are quite happy to nest in winter wheat, actually. We're looking at, in conventional spring tillage, one nest to 150 to 200 acres, whereas in high duck population areas, we can see anywhere from one nest to every 10 to 15 acres in a winter cereal.
Well, why do they go and nest in the fields?
Ducks nest upland. They do all their raising young and covering from the adults, covering from predators in wetlands. But they do their nesting upland, and I do believe it's a predator type relationship where the farther away they are from wetlands and the more cover they have, the less chance they have of being found. And with an awful lot of acres and large fields, it's a great place for them to nest. Pintails, for example, a big concern species for us, are very apt to nest in winter wheat. Not necessarily because of the winter wheat, but because winter wheat is direct seeded, a good agronomic practice to trap snow and to keep it survive over winter. Pintails are very prone to go seed in or to go nest in standing stubble areas. So we're seeing a real direct relationship between winter wheat and pintails in southern Alberta.
Sounds like a real win-win program. Thank you very much, Dale.
Thank you.
That was Dale Suthart, a winter cereals agronomist with Ducks Unlimited Canada. That piano piece was composed by yours truly, and it's called Forest Awakening. And just speaking about forests, over the last few years, public pressure to better manage our forests has led to the development of a number of different certification schemes. In Alberta, for example, industry looks to programs developed by the Canadian Standards Association, the Alberta Forest Products Association, and the Forest Stewardship Council. And retailers like Home Depot promote the fact that they sell lumber from certified forests.
but the number of certified forests throughout the world is really quite small. Dr. Kees van Koten is an economist who has tried to uncover the factors that drive certification. In the study he did for the Sustainable Forest Management Network, he discovered that along with a country's economic well-being, gender also plays a big role.
Well, really, I'm interested in a broader area. I'm interested in what's known as the environmental Kuznets curve and how it applies to forestry. And the environmental Kuznets curve is a theory, or kind of a theory, that says that as countries develop, as their incomes increase, that you first get a further degradation in the environment. So you get greater degree of deforestation. You get less sustainable development or sustainable forestry. And then as incomes rise, that begins to turn around. And what happens is at some point people begin to demand more of the environment, in which case that's what they get. So what you see is what's called an inverted U curve. As incomes rise, you first get deterioration, and then as incomes rise further, you get improvements in the environment.
What really accounts for that?
Well, it's a type of good that the environment is. People aren't interested in buying the environment when they're worried about eating, all right? But it comes a point where suddenly, you know, they have money to buy all kinds of goods, including environment, and that's basically the reason. Technically, it could be, you know, a substitution in income effects is what it is. At the beginning, the income effect is so small that as incomes increase, you don't care about the environment, but as incomes increase further, you care more and more about the environment.
So is that why we're seeing a rise in demand for certified products? Does that relate to that?
Absolutely. That's one of the factors that relates to that. So what I did was I was interested in two things. I was interested in deforestation, what causes that across countries, and I was interested in forest certification across countries. So the first thing I looked at was deforestation, and I tried to find this U-shaped curve, couldn't find it. What happened was as countries began to get richer, they simply began to have lower rates of deforestation. In fact, there came a point where they actually began to reforest or increase forest area. Then I turned around and I looked at forest certification.
Does that mean that the Kuznet curve is not valid?
Yeah, that's hard to say. I think the theory is fine, but the empirical evidence, and most people look at SO2, particles in the air, carbon monoxide, and those kind of things. The problem is there's only data for the U.S. and a few other countries. So what they do in the U.S. is they look across various states, and that's been a mixed bag. I mean, some people have found this U-shaped curve. Other people have found that actually as incomes go up, you get an increase in SO2 and other kinds of pollutants. All right, but I was interested in these cross-country things, and because of my SFM work, I was interested in certification and deforestation.
One of the things that you've mentioned in the article that you've published is that you have essentially two forms of government or policy dealing with how we deal with our forests now. One is the government regulation, and then the other is dealing with this private sort of force where certification comes in. Could you explain that?
Okay, governments, in particular in British Columbia, where I'm from, is probably the best example where governments have tried, because of environmental pressure, have tried to regulate what's done in the forest. And as a result, British Columbia has a forest practices code, which if you stack the books that make up that forest practices code, you're probably looking at two stacks of about 10 feet each. And that's not very, very useful. Now, what happened was in Rio de Janeiro in 1992, there was an attempt to come to an accord on forestry, and that never happened. So what happened was that a number of environmental groups got together with some forest companies and some governments as observers. They started the Forest Stewardship Council shortly after 1992. The intent of the Forest Stewardship Council was to certify tropical forests. But what happened was, in response, private companies and private landowners started their own certification programs for forests in northern countries. So the landowners in Europe and in Canada and the U.S., it was private companies, the big ones.
Well, there's certainly a push now within Canada to get Forest Stewardship Council certification. But one of the things, too, is that when you look at all the different countries, everybody has a different land ownership scheme, and so things may apply somewhere but not somewhere else, and these are issues that have been dealt with. What are the things that you found in your study that would be comparable between the countries?
Okay, so what I did was you've got two forms of certification here, basically. You've got that certification that was started by the Forest Stewardship Council, by environmental groups, and you had certification schemes that were started as competitor schemes on domestic level in northern countries, in the rich countries, in the forest, the timber-producing countries of the world, like Canada, the U.S., Russia to much lesser extent, Scandinavia, and the European countries. And what the attempt there was to take the wind out of the sails of the FSC, all right? And it was very successful. In almost all of the industrial countries, the industrial forest countries, the domestic schemes led all the other schemes. So in Canada, for example, all of our forests that are certified under the American scheme called the Sustainable Forestry Initiative, or under the Canadian Standards Council Forest Certification Scheme. Very little under FSC.
Well, how important are these forest certification schemes?
These schemes are important for the companies involved, but when you look at global forests, the problem is that less than 5% of them are certified. If we look just at Western forests, so industrial forests, if you like, in North America, only about 17% of all forests are certified, which isn't a very large amount. In Europe, it's about 8%. But in other regions of the world, so the FSC was targeting all of these tropical countries, it's only 1%. So it's extremely small when we're talking about forest certification. It's not a big thing. And yet, when we look at FSC, the role that FSC plays in forest certification, it's also very small. When we look at North America, for example, take Canada, 60 million hectares are certified, but only about 7.5% are certified under FSC. Surprisingly, the U.S. has more of its certified forests, about 20% certified under FSC. In Canada, about 15 to 20 million hectares are certified under each of SFI, the American scheme, and the Canadian Standards Council scheme. 60% of all SFI, American scheme, forests that are certified in Canada, all right, which is another bit of a surprise to me. So what I did was I took all the countries who had certified forests, and then I looked at a whole bunch of countries who didn't have certified forests, and I divided them into whether they were a domestic scheme, whether that was the European, whether that was the American-Canadian scheme. I lumped those all together, and I looked at the Forest Stewardship Council scheme and kept that separate on one of my studies. And I tried to then investigate what factors were driving forest certification across countries, not across companies, but across countries. So why would a country be interested in certifying its forest? Well, there's a number of reasons, of course. One is to promote exports. So one would think that a country with a large number of exports would have more of its forest certified than countries who didn't have a lot of exports. And that's about what the data showed. And it showed a number of other things. So high-income countries would certify more of their forests than low-income countries, and so on and so forth. But the big surprise to me was the fact that gender played a role.
In what way?
Well, it turned out I created a variable on my own which tried to mimic whether or not women were exploited in a particular country, yes or no. And if women were exploited, I expected, based on some readings I had done of some writers in anthropology that looked at forests and made the argument that women were interested in forests for sustenance. In other words, they liked sustainable forests. Men were interested in forests for exploitation. In other words, to make money, cash. So my thinking was that if women had a role in the environmental movement and were able to influence government, then we would see more of the forest certified in countries where women had this role. So if women were exploited in a country, you'd expect less of their area to be certified. So if we look at Scandinavia, we'd expect that forests, a large proportion of their forests would be certified because women are not exploited. Women have a big role in and a big voice in government and what happens. The same thing maybe to a little bit lesser degree in Canada and the U.S. and so on. However, if you go to countries where you might expect women to be exploited, you'd expect less of the forest to be certified because they don't have the role or the ability to influence the political process. And that's exactly what my data found, that in areas where my variable, and remember, it's a variable that I created myself to try and mimic, try and determine whether women were exploited or not. And one of the big factors that I used to develop that variable was the difference between literacy rates between men and women. If there was a large difference, my variable would say that women were exploited.
So what does this really mean?
Well, it really means that, you know, and I've got four daughters, it simply means that women are important, that it's important that women have a voice in political processes, that women should have a voice in determining what's happening to a country's environment.
What does this say, then, in terms of where we are now with forest certification?
Well, the problem with forest certification is that it's growing so fast. For example, when I did some of my original work, it was based on 2003 data. Swedish forests had hardly any FSC certified forest. Now it dominates Sweden. So the changes are occurring every year. It's going so fast that it's hard to keep up. So really, the results of this study should be redone at this particular point in time.
Thank you very much.
Okay, you're welcome.
That was Dr. Kees van Koten, a professor of economics and a Canada Research Chair in Environmental Studies and Climate Change at the University of Victoria. He's also a researcher supported by the Sustainable Forest Management Network. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during this program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our weekly newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by Ducks Unlimited Canada, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, Alberta Pacific Forest Industries, Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, the University of Lethbridge, Alberta Ingenuity, ICOR, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, the Alberta Research Council, Science Alberta Foundation, and the Alberta Conservation Association. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.